your reaction to the latest national news, from the ongoing fallout from the protests in Charlottesville to today's rally in Phoenix. Last night, the president gave a primetime address to lay out a strategy for the war in Afghanistan. Despite his campaign calls to withdraw from the fighting, the president says U.S. forces will remain in the region. He did not specify how many more troops would be added or for how long. Some Trump supporters reacted negatively to the new plan, which they say is an about-face. And GOP leaders in Washington are keeping a close eye on the president's message at a rally in Phoenix today, in the wake of the events in Charlottesville and Trump's recent criticism of Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Nevada. I'm Keith Shortall. Today, we're going to discuss the current political climate in our nation's capital and here in Maine. And as always, we want to hear from you. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Last night, the president addressed the nation and discussed his administration's plans for fighting the war in Afghanistan. A few weeks ago, he had hoped to unveil his infrastructure plan, but the events in Charlottesville and the differing responses to those events by the president left all the talk of infrastructure investments by the wayside. Today, we're going to discuss the national political scene. What do you think the administration should focus on? Are you happy with the role that Maine senators are playing? In the studio with me, Jeannie Hay. She's the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New England. Jim Melcher is professor of political science at the University of Maine at Farmington. And Colin Woodard is the state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram. His most recent book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. And as always, we want to hear from you. What was your reaction to the president's speech last night on the war in Afghanistan or his reaction to the Charlottesville protests? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome, everybody, to Maine Calling.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So in his national address, as we said, the president announced he will commit to keeping troops in Afghanistan. He did not say for how long or by how much he would augment the 85-some-hundred troops currently deployed there. Colin Woodard, this is concerning to many Trump supporters who say he's kind of changing a tune. He often whistled during the campaign about what a waste of time and money this engagement in Afghanistan has been.
Yeah, and the president acknowledged that as he was making his remarks, that he was, in fact, changing his position. But from what the president has said, it sounds like the logic of the established view on Afghanistan and what our options are and what we can and can't do, he seems to have accepted it. What he's saying is not all that unlike what we might have expected Hillary Clinton to do in Afghanistan or what President Obama was doing, essentially that we have a situation we would like to get out of. We don't want to be stuck there forever. However, if we just up and leave now, there's the understanding that it might create a void wherein the Taliban and ISIS and whatever other terrorism groups can go back in there and, you know, have a zone to operate, which is precisely, you know, why we got involved in the first place, that al-Qaeda had been training in Afghanistan for 9/11 and other operations, and here we are 16 years later. I mean, nobody likes this because, you know, are we ever going to get out of it? And, you know, is the, you know, anyone who's gone into Afghanistan from the Soviets on backwards has discovered how difficult it is to ever win, in quotes, in Afghanistan. So I think that's the problem. But, you know, in foreign policy, it's often, you're choosing between two bad choices and picking the least bad one. And I think at least in this case, we're seeing the president is realizing that. And, here we are.
Jim.
I was going to say, I think part of what's interesting about this is it shows a change in the power of his advisors. I think this would have been a very different speech and different set of policies if Steve Bannon were still there trying to appeal to that particular base. This certainly seems to be a sign that John Kelly and some of the other people with a military background are having more sway. He kind of split the difference in terms of what the military wanted him to do. He's been getting criticism saying, well, this was a bland speech and it didn't have detail. I was seeing Senator Murphy from Connecticut ripping him for reading off a teleprompter, which is the ultimate in irony. It was one of the sillier things Republicans hit Barack Obama about. He reads off – who doesn't read off a teleprompter these days? I thought in a lot of ways Trump came off a lot better looking, more scripted, more careful. When he goes off the cuff like he did in his second talk about or his third talk about Charlottesville, where he just went completely off script, I think that's where he really gets himself into a lot of trouble. I thought this showed a certain discipline on his part, even if people want to parse some of the policy things. I thought in some ways it was a reassuring sign from him compared to a lot of the stuff we've seen from the president up to this point.
But Jeannie, hey, not reassuring to those Trump core people who are looking at this, looking at the departure of Bannon, and then looking at this what they see as an about face in Afghanistan, and are wondering, this is not the guy that we elected.
Very possible, and I'm sure that there are some core Trump supporters who are feeling that way. But we've also seen that core Trump supporters are pretty much, for the most part, willing to stick with him independent of what he says or does, partly because they feel that they have no better alternative. So I mean, many of us, and I'm included among them, have talked about, oh, this is going to be the beginning of the end for Donald Trump, and it just never happened. So I don't expect this to be one of those either. It's interesting about the speech itself. I had similar observations to Jim, but actually some different conclusions. And because I knew I was coming today, I deliberately haven't listened to any of the pundits or read any of the analysis because it's sometimes frustrating when you feel like you've developed your own conclusions and then the TV or the radio tells you what to think. So I don't know what people are saying, but my impression, I listened to the first half of the speech on the radio on Maine Public, as it so happens.
Good plug.
and I thought, wow, this is the most presidential that I have ever heard him say or sound, excuse me. And, you know, like remember back in the campaign when he was embarrassing himself many times and people say, you're not acting presidential. He said, just wait. I'll be as presidential as anybody in the whole wide world has ever been when I become president. And it hasn't happened. But then I heard him slowly with good cadence, with a somewhat, you know, reasonable argument. I have a lot of disagreements with it, but an argument. And I thought, wow. And because he began first with a real cry of support and recognition for our military, and then he went into how we need to have a united country and that if we're divided, we can't fight our enemies. You know, he seemed to be doing what a lot of people thought. Then the second half I watched on TV, and I had an entirely different point of view or reaction, I should say. And Jim, you said, who cares if he reads the teleprompter or not? I've never seen anybody read a teleprompter as badly as Donald Trump did last night. He was literally looking right to left. I felt like he was in a tennis match. And you know, when he is reading, his whole body language changes. There's somebody else's words. And it was all... It almost seemed like it was all he could do to not go off script. And I certainly agree with you that he gets in trouble when he goes off script. And he didn't do that or almost not at all last night. But I found the sincerity behind it in his body language really problematic.
And he's probably going to be off script a little bit at this rally in Phoenix today. That's maybe part of the point is to bring back some of that.
Well, just quickly on that, I'm really worried that any unity that he sowed last night. And like I said, I was pleased and impressed that he was saying many of the right things. He could squander it all if what happens in Phoenix tonight looks like a big white supremacy rally. And, it's not hard to fill a big audience with fringe folks that look like, you know, maybe they're representing all of Trump's base, whether they are or not. And if he treats this like a regular campaign rally, like he has done many of these, I fear he squandered his moment.
And we'll get to the rally, too, in a minute. But I wanted to bring back something that was said about the core Trump people won't abandon him no matter what. But we saw Steve Bannon returning to Breitbart, Colin, and really laying into Trump. About this Afghanistan thing. But will people see that and other Trump supporters as just sort of sour grapes, or will they agree with Bannon?
Well, I do agree that it seems like there's a core base, how big it is, we don't know, 26, 30% that seems to be with the president very solidly regardless. So, you know, I don't expect to see a absolute collapse in that. But on the edges, will you lose marginal support? And there is a Bannon wing or a Bannon segment of that Bannon represents of his base that's concerned about overseas adventurism, that wants us to invest in ourselves, to not, you know, to withdraw from world leadership in order to concentrate on problems and domestic problems at home, and also wants to do things like, you know, infrastructure investments. And and Bannon's even proposed, you know, a surtax on the wealthiest households and a number of things that are contrary to the Republican Party's establishment position for a couple of decades. The segment that is enthusiastic about Trump for those reasons that might be called populist in economic terms, in terms of where the federal budget's going to go and how money is going to be spent, they may have cause for disappointment now, because Bannon was the biggest voice for those sorts of things, which are relatively popular compared to some of the other things within Trump's agenda. And that voice won't be there within the White House on those particular issues. And you're probably going to see some sliding back on that. And I would expect that that will cause a small but noticeable decay in support in that one part of it. But is it enough to be decisive in American politics? I doubt it, but it's, you know, it will probably be a noticeable movement of the needle.
Yeah. Jim?
I agree with everything Colin said. One thing I would note is I think Trump was aware, or somebody made him aware, that that was a potential problem. And one of the things that struck me about the speech was how far he went out of his way to reject the neoconservative approach to foreign policy we saw under George W. Bush, under Dick Cheney, which has an idea that the United States has a moral obligation to spread democracy, you know, almost a Woodrow Wilson type notion of obligation. He went out of his way to say, we're not nation building, we're not going to do this. And I translated that as, don't worry, I'm not George W. Bush, I'm a different kind of Republican. I think he could lose some of those people you're talking about, but one, where will they go? And two, I think really the core of Trump's support likes him more for his style than specific stances on issues. Mm-hmm. You know, he said, well, the healthcare system will be better than ever, and I won't settle for anything other than everybody being covered. And he clearly supported some Republican plans that wouldn't have done that, didn't seem to hurt him. People think, well, he's, you know, this is what he has to do to drain the swamp. This is what he has to do. They like the confrontation. They like the approach. I think a lot of that core is still going to cut him a lot of slack on the specifics as long as his style remains appealing to them.
But even within his own party, as we're seeing, not only poll results, but even with only key figures in his own party are at an interesting point about whether to be behind him. And as we return here to Phoenix and the importance of this thing, as you said, Jeannie, people are watching to see if this undoes some of what he did last night, but also, again, whether it brings back this anxiety about white supremacy and that whole theme. But also politically, they're looking at his criticism recently of Jeff Flake, the senator from Arizona, whom he called toxic. And GOP Republican leaders in Congress are watching very closely to see how that goes and what they're going to how they're going to respond to that if it goes in that direction.
Yeah, that is a very interesting dynamic, because we have in Arizona Jeff Flake and John McCain, two senators who have been on the unhappy side of Donald Trump's Twitter account and other kinds of things. So the state of Arizona could, one way to frame this could be to say they're going to have to pick between Trump and their senators. And you, that really is a metaphor for the whole country of the GOP being anti-Trump or pro-Trump. My guess, though, is that the visuals tonight will be a very pro-Trump rally. I mean, it's his rally. It's not Flake's or McCain's. And that's going to be the narrative, even if sitting at home, most Arizonans might think, you know, I think Jeff Flake has some good points, and so does John McCain. So I think because he has the bully pulpit, and also because he's so good at manipulating, and I don't say that necessarily in a pejorative sense, but manipulating visuals and tag phrases. And again, I returned to his speech last night. He spent a lot of time, and those speeches, you can't go on forever, just praising the military, our soldiers, our generals. You know, nobody has more honor. Nobody's sacrifice is greater. I mean, you'd think that he had led people into war, which of course he hasn't. But I think that is very much his tapping into a part of his base and a part of American culture that when you start praising veterans and military folks, that is untouchable.
Well, especially among his supporters. But I think one other thing also to get back, not to beat a dead horse about his staff, but I can't think of a president that had more people with extensive military experience on his staff, his chief of staff, lots of these sorts of folks, or somebody who didn't have any military experience himself. You know, some of that was something people called attention to, all the deferments he had. So I think part of that is just the nature of his base finds that very appealing. But I think this is a reflection, again, of the post-Bannon staff that he's got, has a very military tone to it and, you know, might lead to more discipline. But certainly it makes sense given the people he's got around him now.
What's interesting, it's not just a post-Bannon staff. It's a post-Priebus staff. And it's a post FBI director
Comey.
Thank you, staff. So at the same time that people are saying, wow, he's gotten rid of his most dangerous and frightening guy in Bannon, others will say, yeah, but he got rid of his chief of staff, who was the most mainstream GOP and the most willing and able to reach out to a broader coalition. And so it kind of could go either way. The last thing I say is he loves being surrounded by generals. He talks about it all the time. I would say what kind of scares me about that is he's not surrounding himself with diplomats. And when you're talking about Afghanistan or anything else, the military side is but one side of the advice you need.
One of the areas he got criticized for was that there was no talk of diplomacy. There was no talk of building coalitions, no talk of doing any of those things. But his selling point has always been, going back to the Republican caucuses and primaries, I'm different. I'm not like those other Republicans. Mm-hmm. John Kasich has never been on his team, you know, turned down apparently what would have been the most powerful vice presidential office in American history. He's never let up on him. I think this is part of how Trump bills himself as being a different kind of politician. It reminds me of Paul LePage a few years ago about when Paul LePage said, I'm not part of the nicey-nicey group in Augusta and I'm going to come and bust all this up. Well, Trump's approach is very much like that. I don't think he sees the fact that he's taken on Flake and McCain and Kasich and all these other – and Susan Collins and all these other people. I think he sees that as part of his brand. I don't think that he sees that as a liability at all.
Real quickly, Colin, before the break, what about the optics in general of having a Make America Great Again rally in the wake of these events in Charlottesville?
No, I would think that would be a very problematic dynamic. I mean, the Charlottesville events were deeply dangerous to the country and to general democratic values, and the fallout from it from the president was very large, whether he's calculated it yet or not. And to be going into a situation where the optics, regardless of what he says from stage, you know, that you could have something that appears to be a neo-Nazi rally in the stadium is not a good thing. It's not good timing, and it's coming right on the heels of something very powerful and divisive for the country.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we would like to hear from you. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Jade Integrated Health, collaborative acupuncture, physical therapy, massage, and yoga in Portland and Brunswick. jadeintegratedhealth.com.
Today, renewable energy comes from solar, wind, hydropower. In the future, scientists hope to make fuel out of kelp, as in seaweed.
You don't need fresh water, you don't need land, you don't need fertilizer. So combined, I mean, it seems like an ideal source for biofuel.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We'll dive underwater to explore a new clean energy opportunity this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 right here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is holding free public screenings of a portion of the upcoming new Ken Burns documentary, The Vietnam War, accompanied by community discussions moderated by Adria Horn, director at the Maine Bureau of Veterans Services. Seating at each free screening is limited and requires attendee ticket reservations. And now we have just one remaining public screening that still has seats. In Bangor at Husson University's Gracie Theater next Tuesday evening, August 29th at 7. To find out more about Maine Public's Vietnam War work and to secure tickets, go to mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a roundup of national political news. With me in studio, Jim Melcher is professor of political science at the University of Maine at Farmington. Jeannie Hay is the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New England. Colin Woodard, currently state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jeannie, during the break, we were talking again about, the optics of this Phoenix rally in the wake of Charlottesville. You wanted to add something.
Well, just much of the conversation, national conversation since Charlottesville, and I just say my niece lives in Charlottesville and actually was at that rally and has shared her experience with us, is kind of like this is the latest point of no return. And, you know, first it was, you know, bragging about groping women. It was calling Mexicans rapists and murderers, a whole series of red lines that Donald Trump has crossed, and turns out that he doesn't lose his support. I think that this is going to be another one of those for basically two reasons. If you look, I mean, many people in the country and certainly news organizations are outraged by how Donald Trump personally responded to Charlottesville. And that was a classic example of when he was reading the teleprompter, he said the right words. I condemn this action in the strongest terms. Then he looks straight at the camera. He's clearly off script. And he says, on both sides, on both sides. And that's his way, meaning to or not, of saying the real me doesn't believe the words I'm saying. But who are the so you have, you know, maybe two-thirds of the country really outraged by that. But who are the folks who aren't outraged? One are the true white supremacists, neo-Nazis, fringe, tiny fringe of our country who are now getting a lot of attention and who I worry are going to show up in Phoenix tonight. But the much bigger group are basic Trump, you know, red state supporters who look at this and say, this is so much ado about nothing, you know. So he said that there was violence on both sides. He said neo-Nazis are horrible. You know, white supremacy is evil. What is all the hullabaloo? Why don't you believe him? And that feeds right into this notion that the national media conversation is out to get Donald Trump, that he could, you know, there's nothing he could do that would please that group. And they say, look, he said the right words. So I actually don't see Charlottesville or anything else changing that narrative.
So I
this,
agree.
Yeah, this group, these people, his supporters, don't see as much the importance of the president's words becoming policy or the power of words and this great responsibility.
No, they often say, oh, you know, he speaks off the cuff, but he wouldn't really do something bad when he was making policy, or he doesn't really mean that. It was just the passion of the moment. They're willing to give him a huge benefit of the doubt when his critics are willing to give him almost no benefit of the doubt because, say, you're the president of the United States. You have to be very careful about what you say.
But it was a big selling point to his supporters. I'm not politically correct. This reminds me exactly.
Yes.
There's a lot that's very similar to Paul LePage. You know, I'm going to tell it like it is. I'm going to be blunt. I'm not going to look calculated and careful. And the national media that are critical of his style on these things are the same people who've always been critical of him. There has never been, at least since the 30s, since people have been keeping track, there has never been a president that had so little media support when he was elected president. There were papers like the Dallas Morning News and the Chicago Tribune that never avoid endorsing the Republican candidate for president. I mean, there were newspapers that had gone over 100 years and never done so. So I think in some ways he sees himself as winning with those sort of people. I'm the truth speaker instead of these, you know, fake media and all these other sorts of things that he says. So I think this is just a continuation of where he's gone all along.
There's also been an unfortunate distraction that the discussion since Charlottesville has somehow been about Confederate statues, because the proximate reason for the rally was the Robert E. Lee statue in Charlottesville. But of course, it's not about statues. I mean, what we should do with Confederate statues and the future of them, you know, I as a historian and somebody who lived in Eastern Europe during the collapse of communism and what happened to the statues in Eastern Europe. I mean, it's a fascinating and important and interesting topic about what we do with the monuments that celebrate our past and what happens when history changes. But that's not really what Charlottesville was about. The debate was about neo-Nazis marching. I mean, the chants weren't "Let's save Robert E. Lee's statue." They were "Jews will not replace us" and "Blood and soil." And they're carrying shields with the fasces, this literal symbol of fascism, on their shields and marching. And, you know, somebody got killed. You know, this is not a discussion about the Confederacy and Robert E. Lee. This is a discussion about radical, violent, white, nationalist movement having moved on and caused a deadly rally. And the president's remarks intersecting with that, I think a lot of his supporters are choosing to go down a narrative that's being created that we should now have a discussion about Confederate monuments, which is not actually what the outrage is that has such clear moral implications.
That's a really, the University of New England is beginning classes next week. And when I welcome the faculty and students back, I'm going to have to address the fact that nuclear war, Nazism, and white supremacy are not topics of historical conversation in our classrooms right now, but they're topics of current events, and that's a real shift.
Question on Facebook for you, Colin. Maryland writes, "I greatly enjoyed American Nations and was sobered by your vision of racism being embedded in the origins of some colonies. Do you see a direct line from that history to Charlottesville, and if so, how do we bend that line toward equity and justice?" That could be a big answer, but I'll get it.
Sure. Thank you first to the shout out for the book. Much appreciated. Not exactly for the reasons of that comments I just made, and that I think the real issue is the rise of neo-Nazism. The statues issue and the future of those and the history of the Confederacy, which is also wound up in white supremacy and a lot of the real radioactive and difficult issues that go back to the founding of our country, parts of our country, and what happened in the aftermath of the Civil War. These are also essential and powerful and important issues that do need discussing. Those ones, that set, do correspond a lot with the writing that I did in American Nations, which is a book about the regional cultures in the country and their history going back to the beginning. But this particular suite of issues around Charlottesville and hopefully not around Phoenix coming up are a separate grouping of things that aren't really about that in their essence.
Mm. We talked about his sort of impermeability the ability of his core to stick with him. But we have seen some polls recently, and say what you will about polls, but in some swing key states, there was one recently, Michigan and Wisconsin, where 64% of respondents said they were embarrassed by the president, 63% in Pennsylvania, as compared to only a quarter of respondents in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin said that they were proud of the president. Mm-hmm. Do we put much stock in these polls around questions like that, or do you still believe that he's doing fine with his core group?
His core group, it's almost by definition the ones who are going to stay
True.
With
yeah.
him, and that seems to be hanging out around high 20s, low to mid 30s, depending on how you ask the question. I'm sure that Donald Trump has lost some support, and part of the reason that he won, and this has become really clear in many different polls and ways of asking the question since the election, is because Hillary Clinton was his opponent. Turns out there were a lot of people, I underestimated this, who were voting against her, and not voting against Democrats, voting against Hillary Clinton, that there's a just a vile hatred for her among a not insignificant part of American society that saw Trump as the lesser of two evils. Now, if a Democrat comes along who doesn't have the baggage of Hillary Clinton, and few of them would have as much baggage as she does, they could change, you know, because it's no longer Trump is no longer the lesser of two evils. But the people who really believe that he's out for the working class white guy in an age of PC policy gone mad, I say they stay with Trump.
I agree. And one of the things that's really striking about looking at Trump is it's not as though his approval was very high when he got elected and it suddenly has gone off a cliff. He and Hillary Clinton were the two least popular major party nominees since the advent of polling. And normally a president starts out with this huge well of political capital that they can cash in. Okay, I'm going to move on this issue, that issue. He doesn't have that. It's really a very strange world in which his approval ratings are astonishingly low for somebody this short in. And I think it's going to make it difficult for him to do things if all he's got is that hardcore with whom he can't do any wrong. This is not normal in terms of presidents and political capital. Mm.
But if we look ahead to 2018, to the elections of 2018, many Democrats might be licking their chops around this problem, these self-inflicted wounds. On the other hand, Colin, Democrats really will have to be very careful about their messaging, right, in terms of being anti-Trump messaging versus finding a Democratic message that resonates with the people that went for Trump.
Right. I mean, I think that's the argument you see on the Democratic side in policy circles about what that message should be. And there seems to generally be an agreement that they don't have a winning one and a sort of internal civil war about what the new one should be. Are they going more progressive and liberal, or are they going more middle of the road to draw in the moderates and the lost, you know, what you call them, Trump Democrats in the heartland? Is it a populist message? Is going to the progressive and liberal side something that would win back the white working classes from the Rust Belt who used to form the shock troops of the New Deal? Have they been lost from years and years of kowtowing to bankers and financial load? I mean, that's the discussion you hear when you follow, you know, Democratic policy Twitter.
What names do you see? So I think Elizabeth Warren is the obvious one for the second of those groups. The more, you know, less progressive, more mainstream. Who are the names you think are associated with that?
To be a candidate?
Yeah.
Cory Booker would be one of them. Yeah. If Joe Biden is serious about running, Biden would be in that
Biden,
category.
You won't win.
Ooh, I don't know. I think Biden would have won that presidential election in a walk. I think he would have won at least 35, if not 40
states. I do,
but
I don't see him winning in 20. I could be wrong.
Now, but there's a different point that I think is important. I don't think this is going to be the great big Christmas present Democrats think it is for two reasons. One, the Senate map is horrible for the Democrats. They've got to defend a lot of tough seats like Joe Donnelly's seat in Indiana that they won because the Republicans went off the deep end and nominated people who were not electable would be the nicest way that I could put that. They're defending a lot more seats, and incumbents are darned hard to beat. The maps that were drawn in 2010 are very favorable to Republicans. This is going to be determined by a generic ballot of how people are going to vote. I think people who think the Democrats are in for a cakewalk in 2018 are really badly mistaken. I don't think that anti-Trump – well, I don't like Trump, but I like Susan Collins. Well, I like whoever my representative is. You know, we've seen that for years. Why do – Fennow's paradox. Why do people hate Congress but love their congressperson? And I think that that's one of the key questions for me is – how much will Republicans do going into this election to distance themselves from Donald Trump, or do they embrace him?
It'll be interesting to watch Bruce Poliquin's
behavior.
And we'll get to that. First, we're going to take a quick break. The number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Also, a note about tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks for a conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tom Ricks. He has a new book out about George Orwell and Winston Churchill. Share your comments or questions by emailing talk@mainpublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Jade Integrated Health, collaborative acupuncture, physical therapy, massage, and yoga in Portland and Brunswick. JadeIntegratedHealth.com. And Waterville Opera House, presenting the rock opera One Way Trip to Mars, featuring an 11-piece orchestra, August 24th through 27th. OperaHouse.org.
Wake up to the world.
Hello, I'm Dan Damon, host of the BBC's World Update program, and I'm here every weekday morning with all the latest global news, views, and analysis. From Tehran to Tokyo, wherever the news is, World Update will make sure you know about it. So don't let the world pass you by while you sleep. Wake up to me, Dan Damon, and wake up to the world.
Weekday mornings at 5, right here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Radio would like to remind all teachers and educators that there is a valuable educational resource you may be interested in. Our PBS Learning Media Service contains extensive digital and classroom-ready resources. This free K-12 educational resource can be found online at mainepublic.org and is aligned with Common Core and national standards. PBS Learning Media, online at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, your reaction to the latest national news. Joining me today, Colin Woodard. He's currently state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram. His most recent book is American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. Jim Melcher is professor of political science at the University of Maine at Farmington, where he has taught since 1999. And Jeannie Hay is the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New England. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Anne in Portland. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Hello and good afternoon. Thank you.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I first have a statement and then I have a question that I'll take off the air. I find that we have a long past due deliberate conversation that is necessary in the context of race, racism, poverty, privilege, and influence. I find that the events of last weekend was absolutely horrific, personally speaking, and I'm sure it was to many others. I think the relationship with respect to statues, our history, justice, and this grand experiment we call a democracy should be honored by a response to what is currently transpiring in our nation. I find, and I believe this to be true, that if it were a group of Native Americans in the streets, in the same context, African Americans, Muslims, Jews, or I dare say any other ethnic or religious minority, that the perspective and the reaction overall would express a different reality than we have realized to some degree or another. And my question is, if these events, these monuments that are traumatic and reflect slavery, its history, are more important than our unity as a nation and the possibility we provide the world as a leader for peace, equity, and justice. No one, then, I believe, would have an issue with someone raising a statue to Osama bin Laden in Manhattan, raising a statue honoring Timothy McVeigh, because they, too, are part of our history. Mm-hmm. And again, I think we stand as a leader in the world, and I believe it's diminishing rapidly.
Right. And if thank you, Anne. I want to get to the panel here. This, although you said it wasn't around the statues, they have been central to this. We saw recently, for example, Bowdoin, my alma mater, moving its monument or plaque.
Anyway, plaque, yeah.
A plaque of Confederate former students, moving it out of the context of this public place into a historical archive, which was their gesture of saying, yes, right, it's historically important, but it doesn't belong here.
Right. I mean, the statues issue, well, I don't think it's the real issue at Charlottesville. It's an important issue that should be discussed as well. And it boils down to, you know, a lot of people talk about, erasing history, which I would be very much against. But speaking as a historian, you know, monuments and monumental statues are about what we choose to celebrate, and usually choosing to celebrate at a particular point in time or politics. And removing a statue or a plaque and putting it in a museum instead of the center of a public space isn't erasing the history. It's saying that we no longer choose to celebrate this with statuary.
Right. So curating it in a different
way. Exactly. Yeah. And what happened in Eastern Europe, I mean, I was based there and I was a student in 89 when communism collapsed and, you know, all the statues were there and the Soviets were occupying the countries I was in. And in the years that followed, the statues were all taken down on my commute home. And what Hungary did is they put them all in a gigantic statue park. A dramatic, you know, park with all these Stalins and Soviet soldiers. You know, they're three stories tall, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very popular tourist site, and also a place for historical memory and for people to confront what the propaganda was about, the history behind each statue. In fact, in terms of understanding what the statuary stood for, why it was there, and the events around it, and the political discussion that surrounded it, far more effective than if they had stayed in their particular locations. So you're not erasing history, nor should you, but you are choosing what to celebrate and not. And I think that there's a lot of confusing of that for some reason or another.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Mark in Portland. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure, go ahead.
I just had a quick question going back to the discussion earlier about potential Democratic candidates in 2020. I was just interested that Bernie Sanders' name didn't come up. I know we mentioned Joe Biden, and given how often Joe Biden's name come up, I've noticed that Bernie Sanders' age comes into the discussion a lot, and he only would be about a year older, I think, than Joe Biden. And I just wanted to, you know, I was just a little curious as to why his name didn't come up during that discussion.
Sanders has tended to suggest that he wouldn't run in 2020 until relatively recently. Biden, on the other hand, has clearly expressed a lot of regret that Biden largely didn't run, even though he clearly wanted to, clearly thought he could have won because of his family situation. So I think to a large extent, you know, you raise a good point that both of them are older than the average candidate would be, though then again, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were much older than average party nominees themselves. I think it's a message from both of them. I think people see Biden sending more messages that he'd be interested in running, whereas Sanders seems to be more interested in developing a particular ideology within the Democratic Party, trying to move them more towards support of single payer that isn't as much about his own candidacy. And I think that's why you're seeing a difference between the two of them.
I would also add that Sanders, you'll recall, you know, Colin kind of talked about the two branches of the Democratic Party, one that's trying to be more mainstream and I don't know, I was going to say milquetoast, that may not be the right word, but not have anything really controversial in its platform, versus the much more progressive and aggressive, kind of working class based, justice based party. And Sanders, of course, was the standard bearer for that in the last election. And as I said, I think Elizabeth Warren is the person going forward. So Sanders might be in there. Biden would be on the other side. So they would be the two oldsters, for lack of a better word, representing those two branches in the party. I just think, I'm not a political consultant, but if I played one on the radio, I would say, Democrats, you've got to find some people who haven't been on the scene for the last 30 or 40 years. You know,
because, you know, how many people were talking about Jimmy Carter at this point in 1976, or talking about Michael Dukakis, or a lot of things. The next Democratic nominee might be somebody we aren't even thinking about talking about. I think they're in a very fluid situation. Yeah. I think that's frankly healthier for them. Parties that
– like Barack Obama in 2010.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, 2008. But parties that nominate people because there's a perception it's their turn tend to do really badly. We saw that with Bob Dole in 96. We saw that with Mitt Romney when he was nominated, John McCain. And I think to a large extent Hillary Clinton, that people said, well, it's her turn. It's time to do this. Parties tend to be served very badly by that kind of move. And I think this year or this coming election, I think the Democrats are going to have a more organic process because there isn't an obvious future standard bearer. And I frankly think that's healthier for their party.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mark, did you want to make one last case for Bernie Sanders before we move on?
I would. I mean, I personally love the guy, and I know a lot of folks who do, especially up here in Maine. I just thought it was particularly relevant, and I think a lot of us are just waiting with bated breath to see what direction the Democratic Party takes from here. And I do hope that people will give at least the policies that Sanders has put forth serious consideration, if not his candidacy in 2020.
All right, Mark, thanks very much for joining us. Let's go to Carol in Cumberland. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thanks so much. Enjoying the program. I'm just horrified and embarrassed continuously by Mr. Trump. And one of the things that just keeps jumping out at me is his lack of any depth of awareness of history, even in a limited way, and of the world, how it works, and of course the fact that he doesn't has no one around him who he turns to for any of that. The other comment I would make is, as I am, he just leaves me speechless that here he is, what, 8 months into his presidency, 7 months, and he's campaigning. I think that's the only way that he can sustain himself. I think he's a sick man, but just any comments on that? And I will get off the air and
all
listen.
Right. Thank you, Carol. Jeannie.
So many people share your concern, Carol, about President Trump's lack of sometimes basic knowledge about history and political developments around the world. Now, many others will be quick to say that that's not the most important thing in a president. That's what you have advisors and entire bureaucracies is to provide that information in the way that's most helpful in the decision-making room. But, you know, I guess it remains to be seen. But I saw pieces of that show up last night in the speech, and I'll just point out a few. First of all, as I said, I thought he was trying and succeeded to a certain extent to be more presidential last night than I've ever seen him. And part of that was showing that he was rational and thoughtful and relying on generals to make his decision. He, in fact, said something along the lines of, I spent a lot of time studying about this. It's hard to imagine that anybody, while he's president of the United States, could spend the kind of time to study Afghanistan, one of the most complex problems, not just in our century, but for many centuries. I don't mean just problems, but societies that has had, you know, very sticky situations when it comes to other countries getting involved for years and years. But he's trying to project that. The question is whether he's successful. And for me, he wasn't successful because he contradicted himself, I think, without knowing it. So one example was he said, and he knows that this appeals to his base, you know, we can't pay for this forever. You know, Afghanistan and our allies and Pakistan have to start sharing the burden for this. It's not fair, you know, that this is all falling on the United States. And then in the next breath said, you know, this is going to be really hard on Afghanistan. We know this is really hard on their people. So we're going to give them financial aid and development aid and presumably military aid to try to make their economy work and therefore make them a more prosperous country who can afford this war. Well, world history and U.S. foreign policy is littered with the graves of attempts to foreign aid your way out of wars. And the idea that that hasn't been tried for the last 16 years and well before is naive. And I thought that suggested that he wasn't really very knowledgeable about the policy history in the Afghan case.
Yep. We have 2 minutes left here. I wanted to get to just a couple of comments about Susan Collins, who there were points in recent months where she seemed to be walking a difficult tightrope. Where is she now? Have things settled out? And how is she playing herself against this Trump presidency? Colin, quickly.
Well, I've gotten the impression that since her vote, her decisive votes on the on defeating the Republican senator's health care plan, it seems like she's really has the wind at her back and has a comfort with that decision. You know, you had the sense that since Trump inaugurated that Senator Collins was on that tightrope and that everything was kind of a difficult balancing act for her. Remember, she came out a year ago in the Washington Post blasting candidate Trump as being unfit for office, right? And so she was already in that position. But since that vote, you know, she was being congratulated at the Bangor airport when she returned and at the Eastport July 4th parade. And it seems to have given her confidence and resolve that I guess you could say her constituents have her back in a way that maybe she didn't before. But that's the impression I've had, is definitely a change in tone and confidence.
Jim, 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, some do. But on the other hand, not to contradict anything Collins said, I thought that poll that PPP did matching her up against Mary Mayhew running for governor was stunning. Here you have the second most popular senator in her state, second only to Bernie Sanders. In Vermont, and you've got a heck of a lot of people on the right wing of her party who really aren't having it about anything that she's supporting. I heard so many people say she could walk right into the Blaine House. I think there's a large core of her party.
Might not get through the primary.
That's my point, is that there's a lot of, you know, that she doesn't have the depth of support in her party that I think some people assume that she does.
Yeah. Mm. Right. But in a state with a very, the plurality of voters are independents, right?
And she's fairly, and they can't vote in closed primaries.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But she's fairly popular with Democrats. But you know, I think you're right about that. But I think the option of pulling a Murkowski, her friend and colleague in the Senate in Alaska, Lisa Murkowski, was primaried successfully and then ran as a write-in candidate and won her Senate seat. So, I believe that course of action would be open to
so
her.
So much more to say.
Interesting.
No more time. Appreciate it. Jeannie, Jim, Colin, thank you for being here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jeannie Hay, Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at the University of New England, Jim Melcher, Professor of Political Science at the University of Maine at Farmington, and Colin Woodard, an award-winning author and journalist who is state and national affairs writer for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's show will be rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join Jennifer Rooks and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tom Ricks for a conversation about his new book. It chronicles the lives of two great freedom fighters, Winston Churchill and George Orwell. Also, for those in the Portland area, we invite you to a special broadcast of Maine Calling from the Portland Public Library. If you'd like to attend, please email talk@mainepublic.org. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.